You're listening to the Doctor Who podcast from Casterbridge with Christian Corley and James McLean. Welcome to the show. It's nice of you to join us. We are here this week to discuss the forthcoming episode of Doctor Who Legends of the Sea Devils. This is the Easter episode. It is the, I'm not sure if this is the extra, I think this is the extra episode or the Christmas, of the 100th anniversary episode is the extra episode. One of the two is the extra episode. Anyway, and it is, we're getting towards the end of Jodie Whittaker's time on Doctor Who. James, how are you doing?
Tickety-boo.
Good, I'm glad to hear it. We spoke in the last podcast, didn't we, about experiences of meeting Doctor Who actors and how much is spent on a ticket to see a Doctor Who person, meet them in person, have a photograph taken, have a chat with them. And it elicited a lot of comments on the... we shared it with the Doctor Who Companion and it was posted there, and a lot of excellent comments and huge discussion has sprung up from it. I gave this to you a few days ago and it's gone absolutely crazy even since then. So we might dip into that a little bit later. That's okay with you?
That sounds relatively exciting in a relative sense to what we do. Don't want to get people overexcited by suggesting it'd be exciting by any other scale or standards. But for what we do, that could be quite exciting.
Yes. Okay.
Relatively speaking.
Legend of the Sea Devils is hitting screens on Easter Sunday. That's just a few days after we're recording this. And it's got Sea Devil in it. At least one Sea Devil. I'm imagining there's multiple Sea Devils in this episode. We've got the trailer for you now, so just do a refresh your memories. Here is the trailer.
Sea Devil.
He's coming straight for us.
That's impossible. Madam Ching! Pirate Queen!
Where's the crew?
That'll be us.
We don't stand a chance.
Yes, did you just stand up like this?
You're like a kid sometimes.
Thanks. Say hello to my crew.
The world has been disrupted.
Because of you. Because of what you unleashed.
You want to create chaos.
It is our time.
Man the cannons.
The ship is going down. Down!
Quite an exciting...
Don't forget to click below and subscribe.
Oh, shut up, Jodie. It's quite an exciting... Sorry, Doctor. It's quite an exciting trailer. I kind of like it. But that horn at the end, we've just got hold of a copy of Star Wars, the Skywalker saga, and it has the sound effect of the mines, the space mines. And when I heard that horn at the end there, I was just thinking of the space mines in Attack of the Clones.
Yeah, it's... Still, we're still in trailer zone of Two Steps from Hell meets Inception, aren't we?
Well,
the Inception horn and a little bit of stringy Two Steps from Hell music combined to, as you say, create exciting trailer.
So this goes out on Sunday night. It marks the return of the Sea Devils, who haven't been seen in Doctor Who properly since Warriors of the Deep. I'm feeling there was...
Since 2010, actually, because I think there was a clip of them in that last montage of the 11th Hour.
I was thinking that as well. I was just about to say, I think they had a bit of a cameo in something.
But yeah, I know, yes. This has been a while since Warriors of the Deep.
Warriors of the Deep. I have a confession to make on that. I haven't watched Warriors of the Deep since 1984, and I do intend to keep it that way.
God,
that might not happen thanks to BritBox.
I don't know. It's just, there's nothing. There feels like there's nothing cool these days. As soon as you utter anything which has 19 as the prefix towards a date, because you just, I don't know, it just feels so. I don't know. So self-aware of slowly growing old and dying in a way that no one ever imagines they're going to do.
Yeah, well, oh God.
Do you know what I mean? We know it's a long time ago. And yeah, I haven't seen it since 1984. I imagine when I was a kid and people go, oh, I haven't heard this song since 1932. And you think, oh my God, what the hell? And you're that person.
Yeah, you think about it, 1984 was 40 years, well, 39 years after the end of World War II.
Yeah, and so that's what I mean. If you
38 years ago now. Mm.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
It gets scary, doesn't it?
I know. Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So, I mean, there was no triviality in that. I was like, when you said that, I was like, my God, that sounds awful. And the weird way I was thinking, like, my brain says 73 for Sea Devils.
Mm-hmm.
Logically,
mm-hmm.
And thinking that's almost like, you know, 50 years, and to think that, you know, if you were, and I know some of the people were, because I remember I read some of the replies in the recent thread that you talked about, which we said later on might be relatively interesting, and there are people talking about those early dates. I think, I don't know, I can't remember, but if they were in this scenario, let's pretend they were, because they might not. You might check that later on and realize they're not there, and I've been lying, and I'm not, I've misconceptualized. But somewhere I read people talking about Doctor Who a long time ago, 50 years ago. And I'm sure I can prove that if I went to anywhere, because people do that, if you know what I mean. But that is scary to think, you know, if you were there in 73 when the Sea Devils were on, and you'd have no idea that 50 years later there would be another titled Doctor Who episode with the Sea Devils. I mean, that blows my mind a bit as well. That's a that massive time, that's half a century, and they're back again, these ridiculous dude actors with rubber things on the top of their heads. Not very convincing, but they're back, dudes with rubber things on top of their heads, who themselves were kind of like reversions of the Silurians, which came, you know, a couple of years before. They weren't exactly really fresh stuff, and now we're celebrating their return 50 years on.
They're a strange design, aren't they? Because they're said to be sort of relatives of the Silurians, and they have a sort of, I mean, they're kind of reptilian in the fact that they're related, and that I believe the face is based around a tortoise.
Makes sense.
At the same time, you do wonder if they're a bit more actual amphibious. Than amphibian rather than reptile, I think.
Well, they've got, And my first encounter with them was in the Doctor Who magazine. I think it was a Doctor Who magazine, and there was a comic strip, a black and white one. And if anyone actually knows what I'm talking about, because they too are crying as they listen to this, wiping their tears with soiled doilies or whatever, thinking back to how old they are. But sometime in the 80s, there was a black and white comic strip with the Sea Devils, which ended with the Sea Devil in question winning and destroying someone. I think it was a big explosion. And the last panel after those was a Sea Devil sort of remarking on it. I can't remember the story. I just remember the sort of shock of this creature winning at the end, and having not seen an episode, because it was prior to Davison's Warriors of the Deep, which of course now makes me feel even older than the point of reference that you made. That was my first encounter with them. And I think they had in the strip their weird guns as well, which again, and they were really mysterious. My entry point to Sea Devils was actually, I'm sure it was Doctor Who magazine. I'll have to see if I can find out what the hell that story was.
Was the Sea Devils one of the ones that was repeated in 1983?
I think, oh, say 83, I don't know. It was repeated in the 90s, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was definitely appearing in the 90s.
On BBC
yeah.
Two seasons,
I remember that. I'm not sure about, yeah, as you say, I think it might have been a Dalek thing in 1983. But yeah,
I think 83 was probably Curse of Peladon.
Oh, you might be right on that. Either way.
My brain, yeah. I'm sure, again, someone who was around in 1983 might remember and might want to tell us.
Yeah. I
think you will find... In 1983, it was the Three Doctors.
You might, yes, you're probably right. In 94, the Sea Devils I watched on BBC Two, unless it was one of the ones that was on BBC One.
Yeah,
I watched it in that run, and I really enjoyed it. So, yeah, That was my first encounter with the Sea Devils. I knew about them before, but I'd never seen them moving.
I mean, I know it was innovative, but I used to hate the music, the soundtrack to that episode, to that story.
Oh, really?
Very famously. Well, bits of it were all right around then, but obviously there's the very famous sparring scene with Delgado and Pertwee, and the music goes into a real crazy zone. And I think they even put it on some of the soundtracks at the time. It's just like, you know, it just doesn't, I don't vibe with it. So
is that the one with the sword fight?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is.
The anime Doctor Who, which I think we mentioned last time.
Mm-hmm.
I might have been talking to my son about it. That borrows that scene. So that there's a sort of a skyscraper or a radio mast or something, and the Doctor and the Master are sword fighting with foils. So it borrows nicely from that. Back to Legend of the Sea Devils. Anyway, this is an episode that has been written by Chris Chibnall with... I had it in front of me.
You said it feels a new name.
It is a new name.
Written by Chris Chibnall.
Oh, you know, I've gone and lost it now. Oh, it's that slick professionalism is back again. Forget the buttons that play their music. It's the slick professionalism of forgetting the thing that I've just read that brings everyone back to the Dot 2 podcast week after week. I've completely lost the name of the co-writer.
Can we say for now...
Ella Rose!
Can we say for now... I was going to go with Pex from Happiness Patrol, but if you
not. It's Chris Chibnall and Ella Rode. And
Ella Rose, that'd be so cool if it was Pex. I mean, it's like, you know, he's had a bad career. Not the actor, the character.
Yeah. No, it's not him. It's not directed Pex. By Hao Lo Wang, and is the 13th Doctor's penultimate story with Mandip Gill and John Bishop reprising Yasmin Khan and Dan Lewis. And I suppose once that's out of the way, we're going to get some sort of trailer for the final instalment of 13th Doctorville. And this has happened now. It didn't really happen with Eccleston so much, but it happened with the 10th Doctor and the 11th Doctor and the 12th Doctor, this kind of a foreshadowing of finality, didn't it?
Mm.
And I'm hoping they don't do that. But looking at how things might be about to turn out next year. Maybe that is what that is. I don't know. It just feels a bit tired at this stage, doesn't it? After 12 years of that kind of...
The finality was there with Tom Baker, Peter Davison a little bit, but not really. Not in the way that you're talking about. Colin, bless him, the finality was all over the tabloids. It didn't need to appear in the episode. Everyone knew quite the doom that was there before it aired. And again, the McGann film was a bit of a mess in that sort of sense. Well-meaning mess, but a mess nevertheless. But yeah, I suppose after that, I suppose Tennant really set it rolling with his doomy ending, which I still have a lot of love for. But I think it depends on how it's done, doesn't it? Because in the end, these are like, they're not just like, Doctor Who's a weird thing, isn't it? It's broken up. It's episodes which we read into seasons, which we then read into eras.
Yeah.
And sometimes those eras are production eras and sometimes they're of the actor. So there's lots of ways to look at them. And this is, you know, again, it's one of those ways where we're grouping it by an era, by actor and production. To some degree. So in a sense, I can understand there is a sort of a more of a need to, or more of a desire to sort of give it a sort of like a finale, because it is recognised by those eras in a way that, to be fair to Hartnell, Troughton, and to some degree Pertwee, wasn't really established yet. And Nathan Turner didn't really get the opportunity to get rid of his era. So I can sort of see the way why they do it and why it is significant.
Yeah.
I think the problem with eras is that because we're so fully aware of them, that it means that so much of the debates and frustrations in fandoms are set by them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there was a Doctor Who fan on Twitter I was reading the other day who was who's a big fan of Capaldi and the Moffat era, you know, and the sort of debates were around, you know, would always circulate around whether Capaldi or whether Moffat was a good era. And I kind of, I don't know, sometimes I think we've done it as well. I'm not saying we've got clean hands on this. We all do it. And sometimes I just kind of feel like it's, I don't know, everything's far more nuanced than that, isn't it? I mean, like in that thread, that poster pointed out several great episodes, because someone said there wasn't many great Capaldi episodes. And they went, how about all these? And I didn't agree with a lot of them. But that's kind of what we do. We cherry pick to create our era. You know, we'll ignore the ones we don't like, and we will either push forward the ones we do like, or we will say we like them all.
I mean, part of that might be actually forgetting the ones that we don't like as well, isn't it?
Absolutely, totally. I'm trying to point no fingers here. I'm just observing the terrain of reviewing of fandom and its consumption, and I suppose again also of the production crews, because, as I say, this is the end of their era, so they kind of want to big it up, you know, the top line people in production. So is that indulgent? Maybe.
I don't know.
But then since we talk about everything in eras, it makes kind of sense that if you want to finish your era, you've got to do what all the other eras have done, and you sort of end it with a bang. You end your movie with a bang. You end your era with a bang. And that's kind of, say, ever since Legopolis, really. I mean, Legopolis was as foreboding as you could get at the time. Even though technically the era wasn't, the production era hadn't ended, although there was obviously changing, but the changes had occurred before that season had started. So I suppose, you know, life's complicated, isn't it?
Well, indeed it is. Did you know, because I'm going into some statistics now, so I'm just going to tell you now that statistically you're more likely to have a white Easter in the UK than a white Christmas.
Oh, okay.
Which I find fascinating, and I can see that. I can think of a couple. This is the first Doctor Who Easter special, technically, since Planet of the Dead, although the 11th Hour went out at Easter as well. Not mentioning the 11th Hour there. Legend of the Sea Devils features the reintroduction of the Sea Devils. In 1984, Warriors of the Deep was featured in set in Sea Base 4, which they teamed up with the Silurians, which I suppose was one of those fan service moments in Doctor Who. And there was also the famous Murker, the bubble-wrapped panto horse it was the same guys as in Rent-A-Ghost, wasn't it? So, some people think the Murker is back in this. It's set on a boat, so maybe don't go into the galley. The episode guests are Arthur Lee as Ji Hun, Crystal Yu as Madam Ching, and Marlowe Chan Reeves as Ying Qi, and Craig Ells as Marcissus, although I'm not 100% certain on the pronunciation of any of those names. But I recognise them all, and they're all really good, so that's cool. Usually we review these straight after, and we're not going to be able to this time because I'm going on a trip next week. So we're going to have a little break from the podcast for a week, which is a bit weird, not having anything lined up, but having stuff that is actually ready to go out. I'm not going to have time to do it all after this one, unfortunately. But I'm going to London next week, which is going to be, I haven't been to London in years, so it's going to be a bit weird, I think. I don't know. When did you last go to London?
Damn good question. I mean, pandemic sort of obviously kills a couple of years of that for me. I don't know. I think the last time I went to London was probably coming through London back off a trip. But yeah, it's been a while.
According to Google Maps, I last went to London in 2018. So that's 4 years.
Yeah, I think I was the same. I think I was there in 2019, but only briefly. It's been a while since I've gone down to London for pleasure. But that's largely a bit of a sidetrack. Is there a reason we're rolling down this?
Well, you see, I
rail track towards a cliff.
I've been to London a few times in my life, and I have never, to my knowledge, seen anyone famous.
Okay, so there's the segue. There we go.
There you go. I've never seen anyone famous in London, to my knowledge. Now, my dad, he's from Bexley, and he worked in London for a long time before he met my mum and joined the Navy, then met my mum, then moved to the Northeast. And he saw famous people all the time. My sister lives in London. I've never spoken to her about famous people, so I'll have to catch up on that. And maybe no one cares, so I won't update you. My best friend from school, who's also my best man at my wedding, he lives in London, coincidentally not far from my sister, although that wasn't intentional. And he sees famous people quite regularly. But I never bump into famous people, never spot famous people from afar or anything like that. I think the closest I've ever got to a famous person that I wasn't expecting to see, because I hadn't like booked to see them or anything, was Rory McGrath outside Cambridge Station. And that was it. Although there was a time last summer when I saw Vic Reeves / Jim Moyer in Helmsley. I suppose that counts, doesn't it? Anyhow, so our conversation last week, which I segued into nicely and then absolutely screwed up at the end there. How much would you pay to meet a Doctor Who actor? The Doctor Who Companion very kindly let us share our podcast with them from time to time. We could do it weekly, but it's too much work, so I just do it occasionally. And so thank you, Philip Bates, for that. And so we raised this whole topic in the last podcast. How much does it cost to meet Doctor Who actors? What's it like when you meet a Doctor Who actor? Do you feel dirty after meeting a Doctor Who actor? Any of these things really we covered, didn't we? Mm-hmm. And there's really, really excellent comments. And a lot of these people have listened to what we've been talking about, which is really very nice. And if you haven't, that's fine as well, because, you know, we're just there to generate a discussion. And there's so much of it now. There was a couple of these I wanted to sort of bring up, but I'm a little bit lost going through it all now. I'm not recognising much of what I saw with the initial conversation.
Because it's grown.
Yeah, it's just grown exponentially. Topic. Yeah.
I see.
So just while we mull on that, just to go back to our own Facebook page where we also shared the podcast, Nick Caulfield, hello, Nick, replied saying that he met various people, Terry Pratchett, Murray Walker, Mark Webber, Damon Hill. I feel like he's showing off slightly, but I'm sure he's not intentionally doing that. But, that era of Formula One racing is sort of like my favourite era. I don't have much time for it these days. And then he suggests what it would be like to actually meet us, which anyone who met us in Manchester a few years ago would know that's a really disappointing thing, Nick. So
yeah, I was terrible, and I'm not even a shy person, but
I'm not sure.
I look back at that. Yeah,
I don't know if I'm shy. I feel like I'm shy. I just think I'm not a very good conversationist.
I think it depends on. I mean, and again, this goes back to beating people who do have cultural currency, but it depends on where and how you meet them. I mean, when people have met me and I've done things like that, and I've done presentation stuff before, and my brain, I don't mean this in a cocky way, my brain is always constantly spinning. So if you come at me to talk to me at a point where my brain is spinning, doesn't matter who you are, I won't properly engage because I can't. I'm not there. So it'll depend on the situation. If you know, everyone was sitting around a table and people came and sat down and were chatting, it'd be a very different circumstance than if someone comes to me where I have no idea who they are particularly. And even if they've come to talk to me and I'm thinking about other things, because normally that circumstance would be in an unusual scenario because people don't tend to come to talk to me like that. I think that is some of the problems. And I think that is a problem for actors as well. And you read about it a billion times over, don't you? This whole thing of, you know, how do you, I think I was, who is it? It was Jason Lee from My Name is Earl. I was watching an interview with him the other day, and he was kind of saying that sort of thing, that, you know, it's very, when people have come to him and sort of said, I watched My Name is Earl, which for those who are too young or too old, in 2008 was a pretty good American comedy about a guy trying to redeem himself, American person at the bottom of the barrel trying to redeem himself. And he'd have people come to him and say, you know, you helped me through a really bad time. I was really struggling, and your show, the positivity in it and the humour helped me through my drug addiction or something. And his feeling was like, in a part of me, can't believe that's true. And that almost makes, I got the impression that I was him sort of trying to say, you know, in a sense, it's not that I'm trying to not believe them, but I can't take it on board. I can't really take my work as a in that sort of metric that I have helped someone through something. And I think on a lower level like us, you know, having anyone come over and say, I listen to this, and on top of that, I enjoy it, is a metric that's really hard to actually sort of put into to qualify. And it's just like, I can't find how I'm going to, how I take that. And I've got nothing to actually quantify against either. So it's just really weird. And I think that's a problem for you and me, I think.
I think, in terms of people, I don't have a lot of, I don't have a huge circle of friends. I'm very much more focused on my family and my extended family. So I don't really go out and see people very often unless they're sort of friends from school, really. Although, I mean, the people that I've met is through Doctor Who, through Casterbris, over the years, none of them I've met in person before communicating with them via email, except maybe Kavana. I'm not 100% certain, but I think I met him before communicating via email at a convention here in Teesside. I may be wrong on that. He may remember. I'm not entirely sure I do, but you know, yourself and Terra Nova, Philip Bates. Oh, I haven't met Philip actually. I'll think about it. And going back to the old days, Anthony Dry. We all communicated by a message and email extensively before, or like this, before actually meeting in the flesh. But I do find that meeting people out of the blue is kind of tricky, including, you know, people that are celebrities and are writers and directors, and just sort of meeting them, people whose work you admire. I find that difficult as well. I just find meeting people difficult.
So do you think, I'm just looking through some of the comments right now that are in the DoctorWhoCompanion.com thread. How much would you pay to meet a Doctor Who actor? April the 9th, if people are interested. And I think there's an interesting thing in terms of specifically with Doctor Who and how, and I think this is obviously a big debate amongst fans, is when you get spaces where the actors can have more space to be themselves. So obviously I think sort of more smaller gigs or more sort of informal than say the London conventions, where everything is a little more cattle market, if I can be so rude, where people are, you know, stationed at, either at tables or they're doing talks. But I certainly went to conventions many a year ago, and, you know, a lot of it was, you know, in the evenings when people would be just out and chatting in the corridors or in the bar or at the, you know, and that sort of space is where I think people, and I think fans as well, possibly get most out of it, where they break down that truthism of, I can't believe that you like me. Would you say, I don't know. That's kind of my memories. I remember one, I think I might have mentioned this because we've been doing this for 10 years. I was at a convention, one of the Star Fury ones that Sean Harry did years ago. And it was for, I think it was around the time Earth Final Conflict and Farscape and all that was around. And one of the Earth Final Conflict guys came over, who's, I think, is, who was it? Was it Robert Lee Shock? I think it came over and we were, my memory is that he was walking down the corridor. I think one of our group had spoken to him before when they'd been doing staffing. As he walked past, we were just sitting on the floor and we just beckoned him over, and he came and he sat down on the floor and he just chatted to us. And I think he just kind of enjoyed, he was just saying, it's just nice to be in a space where I don't feel threatened. I don't feel that I'm overly admired, because I think that can be uncomfortable. There was a wife and a husband who came over. The husband pulled the wife over, was really embarrassed, but wanted to meet him. And the actor, I think it was Robert, was really awkward about it, because obviously there was a tension because the wife didn't know what to do. And it was just sitting and chatting to people who were just going to talk to him as a person. And that was nice. And I think that's, in those sort of senses, I think those kind of meetings, obviously where money's not involved, take the money out of the table, which obviously needs to be there for their livelihoods. But in terms of actually interacting, as soon as you get that out of the way and people can just talk, I certainly think, and I know, I've got to be careful here because I have no experience of American conventions. I've only heard what American actors have said. The British ones are often quite informal, which from what I've heard anecdotally has sometimes been quite good for them. But I don't think they mean, as I say, like the London ones, which, no offense to the London ones, are more part of a bigger themed thing rather than a specific thing. I'm trying to cover you looking for your through your list.
Yes. Of I think the one I found, the one that raised my interest is that I think I found it now. So thank you for
that. Okay, good, good. That's no worries. I'm here to support your unprofessionality with my lack of preparation.
It was Rick Lundin. And the reason I couldn't find it is because it was well down the list, and the list automatically sorts by either the most popular or the most recent. And it's a good post by Rick, and you've got five up ticks, but if I'm not sure if it was the most popular or not, but that's by the by. Basically, Rick replied to another comment to David Mullen about pricing, and Rick makes a good point. He says, I think we should at least give Piper Mackey and this generation of actors the benefit of the doubt as per their attitude and preferences. Quite often, it's the current rate and competitive nature of business managers and agents that set these things up. These actors today are usually either more in demand and or established a brand that their handlers and advisors take advantage of. Not to make excuses, but I think in some cases these celebrities either live in a bubble or assume this is simply how things are done today. And I think another factor, he goes on to say, is the reselling factor on eBay. A celeb could very generously sign something for a tiny sum, only to have that fan sell it online for 10 times as much, and some do. And I think that is one of the major factors agents and managers bring up to validate these enormous fees to their clients. And in many cases, they're not wrong. And I think that is in response to the suggestion that David Tennant basically charges the price of a house for a weekend, according to a comment on this thread, which, I mean, is entirely believable, the way things are going these days. And if you put it into that context, then you can kind of see why these fees are so high, can't you? And then why this is then filtered down into the ticket price.
It's funny, isn't it? Because, you know, we talk about people knowing people. It's like, I mean, I've read, I'll be honest, and I hope if Philip listens to this, he doesn't take his offence. I don't often go to Doctor Who Companion because I don't tend to go to many websites these days. But like Rick Lundin, I've seen his avatars and I've seen his comments before, and I haven't replied to them, I don't think. Might have done many years ago. But, you know, it's weird how we can kind of know people without them knowing that we know them, if you know what I mean. So in a sort of sense to me, is someone, oh, I know his sort of stuff. I kind of knew what his take would be. I had a kind of a feeling of where he sort of situates himself in that sort of Doctor Who political spectrum. I kind of agree and I kind of disagree, because I think one of the things that that Doctor Who fans, when they talk about this, seem to lose a little bit of sight of. No, that's maybe a bit unfair. That sounds a bit... I'll put it this other way. I think one thing that perhaps isn't talked about is the fact the Doctor Who brand has exploded in the last 20 years. You know, it has exploded globally in a way where their actual value has increased as well. You know, these are no longer, you know, it's no longer simply a British thing, and people will come from across the world to see to meet these actors. So, in a sense, their value is kind of, whether it's right or wrong, is cushioned by the fact that that is their industry value. And yes, it is set. And yes, they could do it for cheaper. But it's like saying, you know, it's like football teams, isn't it? You know, you say, you know, footballers are paid too much. It's like, well, they're paid what is deemed to be their value. You know, and at that value, the people are paying for it. So that value is being met. Do you see what I mean? It's like that is the market value, and that's largely because the show's star has risen far more than we ever really think about. When it used to be a show which was broadly British based, you know, obviously sold to Australia and to America and across, but it didn't have that cultural cachet. It didn't propel its stars into Hollywood, you know, regardless of some of the wins and losses of Matt Smith or Karen or David Tennant. You know, it gives incredibly big market value. And also, fandom has exploded in the last 30 years, in terms of its value as a circuit, as a market.
Yeah.
So these things factor in, and I'm not for a minute trying to justify the prices, But I can also at the same time kind of understand why they're able to do it, you know, because there's only so many people who can be Doctor Who in the world, and yet all the world knows them. And obviously other the ones associated with like Piper and Mackie and the like. Yeah, I understand what Rick's saying. At the same time, I'd say Piper and Mackie are part of Doctor Who when it's become a big, big industry, big, big industry. Well, before it was, you know, it was a British industry. So the eras are different. But I think also what he says is interesting. I mean, do they understand? Do they have a feeling on this? Is it something they're comfortable with? Is it something that's put on them? Is it the business managers and agents and their negotiations with these with the circuit? Is that what's doing it? I mean, I remember back in the early 2000s, David Boreanaz, Angel from Buffy, his price to come over to UK was massive. Possibly nothing compared to this now. Buffy was a global market. You know, he was the lead angel, he was the lead star. So, you know, the amount that they would have to be charging to cover everything and we, and his fee was a lot. And I remember one of the convention managers saying that they couldn't afford him, essentially. So that's because it was a big global industry. Now, Doctor Who is that? They're doing the same. Should it be like that? No, probably not. But while people are willing to pay for it, that becomes the market value. That sucks a little, but it's an interesting point. I really, I mean, he knows what he puts in good ideas and stuff to debate on. Any others in there that interested you?
There probably was, yeah. I've kind of gone off the topic slightly because I've just remembered something that I saw.
What's that?
The link to that will be in the show notes. If you only were engaged in that conversation or have a look through and see what you think and whether it ties in with what we said or your own thoughts on the matter, by all means, head over to the Doctor Who Companion and have a look at that. I spotted a picture of Peter Davison on the internet. And it just reminded me, because I was wondering whether he gets anywhere like, I mean, he should.
Is this the one with Tennant and the line?
I don't know what that is. No, the picture that I saw was, it was on Facebook. It was from the Big Finish page. And it was basically, it was literally the Fifth Doctor. He was dressed and he was recording as the Fifth Doctor wearing the cricket.
Oh, right.
Which I thought was kind of, was nice. He's kind of, he's doing it, he's playing himself method.
That's interesting. It'd be interesting to see that done as well. See him doing that in the flesh.
Yeah. But I mean, I do wonder what the the thing you're talking about is him saying this, putting a sign up or something, and then there's a photo of him in the David Tennant queue saying that he's more interesting.
Yes, that's the word. Yes. I just thought that was more on topic, so I thought that's what you talk about. Yes. It was I think Janet Fielding tweeted it, so retweeted it, which is where I saw it.
Yeah, but I wonder. I mean, surely, I mean, if David Tennant's £120,000, you know, this is just a figure we're throwing out there. Call it $100,000, all right, just to be in the middle and not to get anyone into trouble and not to mislead anyone. Well, let's just call it $100,000. What is Peter Davison? Surely Peter Davison, he's, you know, he should be five times that, shouldn't he? He's five doctors before. Is he getting £500,000 for $500,000 for every two convention he does? I doubt it.
Like you say, it's become a big industry. I think it's a shame. I can understand why, especially some of the older Doctor Who fans find it frustrating when you look back at the days. You go onto YouTube and you'll see the videos of Doctor Who and Blake Seven conventions where you've got Gareth Thomas and Paul Darrow from Blake Seven in a smoky room chatting to like 20 fans in a severely informal world.
Yeah.
And, you know, you suddenly go into a world of conventions where to get any sort of contact or interaction, it's all very clinical and financially worked. And like you say, as soon as they cost a lot, you know, these places have to be careful how they actually make sure that that's covered. So, it's a
I suppose we're probably doing Gareth a disservice with this because, you know, all through all this sort of big era of the huge convention, he's been running little conventions and obviously events of the past few years have kind of put a... the mockers on all of that, but he was running some very small intimate conventions in pubs and clubs in Manchester, and they were very good conventions and they were intimate and you could talk to people without too much trouble, famous people, other people, other Doctor Who fans and whatever. And in fact, it's so important that we don't forget that. I'm going to put a show note link to our chat about hosting conventions.
But I think that's also another point, is that from a business manager's point of view, or representative of an actor, you've got to look and go, and again, it's the same like with football, you look and go, this convention is going to be wildly advertised as a massive thing with several hundred people in a space where everyone can get in central London.
Yeah.
How much are these people going to make from all those people coming to see my client? How much am I going to bring them? So how much value has my client got to this circus, to use a harsh term? While it's something like Gareth's events, where it's a far more small time, where he is not making vast amounts of money, and sometimes he has connections as well. But beyond those, maybe that is another thing that which negotiates it. You know, the smaller spaces, you know, actors and their representation are going to be a little less concerned as they would be, as I say, with a big organisation about to make a lot of money from all these, from essentially, as I say, it is a little bit like a market.
I think the football allegory is, I think it's quite a good one, actually. I follow I don't follow many footballers. In fact, I probably don't follow any footballers apart from one on Twitter.
Okay, so you do, right. As long as there was one, otherwise that was a very interesting ramble.
And one club. And the club I follow is Middlesbrough FC, and the sole footballer is Bernie Slaven, who played for Middlesbrough in the late 80s and early 90s. And he lives locally, still lives on Teesside. He's not from Teesside, he's from Scotland. And he still lives on Teesside, and he's kind of when you know, you'll see him in Costa Coffee chatting with people. He goes on local radio and stuff. He's quite a well-known local figure, so everyone kind of knows him around here. And he tweets photos of his morning walks and runs with his dogs around Rugby Topping in sort of the Stokesley Yarm sort of area. So you're getting onto the Yorkshire Moors away from the industry that we live near, and. So there's that side of football, and he's from that generation where they weren't earning 30, 40, 150,000 pounds a week. They were lucky if they were earning that in their entire contract with the club. And yet it's less than 40 years ago when he was playing football professionally. And then, you know, at the same time, you know, I could see a photo of that. And then 2 days, scrolling later on, I see a photograph of Juninho, the Brazilian international, and Gareth Southgate, the England manager, who both played for Middlesbrough at the same time, probably within 15 years of Bernie Slaven leaving the club. And, you know, they both got £1 million in the bank at the very least. And it's mind-blowing how that industry just flipped completely with the round from 92 onwards, but it really sort of went into the sort of overdrive sort of around the turn of the century. And the money that's in football now, and it is a smart comparison, I think, James, with not just Doctor Who, but sort of like the whole sort of culture around specific TV shows and franchises. Because football's essentially a franchise now, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, and it's based on numbers and market values. That's the way it all rolls.
Yeah.
It is a shame. I mean, it goes back to something you said at the very top of this show, if we can call it a show, and if there really was a top, that we don't...
But there's definitely a bottom.
there's definitely a bottom, a long-running bottom. you come to our show and you fall immediately 10 years ago into the bottom of the barrel, and then you're just rolling, and you're quite shocked that it's constantly a downward slope as well. The barrel is sloped. You know, we've still not found the other end, but the slope is the slope's not too deep. Obviously, it's got 10 years, so the incline's there. It's a bit like a Greek myth that we are playing out, some sort of torturous purgatory.
Yeah.
But what you were saying at the top of the bottom of the show, or the bottom of the top of the show, this idea that once you've spoken to people, how do you feel? And there is always that thing that when you meet people that you have a lot of admiration for or interest in, and that meeting doesn't go quite as you want, and probably how you want it is an impossible thing. And that's not to say that you want a great friendship, but how people come away from those meetings is, you know, can be. I mean, I remembered I've had ones where I've come away just feeling just for the rest of the day thinking, I wish I'd said something, or I wish I'd said so-and-so better, or I wish I had thought of so-and-so, or I wish I'd had a little more time, or maybe I could have. And because those meetings are so short, if they are those sort of like meet, greet, sign things, I think sometimes I think they're more harm than good, because they're moments that can never live up, rarely can live up to your expectations.
No, yeah. I think that's how I feel about the Tom Baker thing, to be honest.
Yeah, I think to me, in some ways, it's nicer just not to engage and just take the curiosity of the moment. I mean, I think, you know, I think there's been times like when we were at the talking of Gareth to some degree, obviously not quite what he was doing, but when he was involved in the Thorpe stuff, when we were over there in Manchester, and, you know, being in the lift with Sophie Aldred or Nicola Brandt or whoever it was, I'm not even sure I can remember who was in the lift at the time. But those were just nice moments. Didn't try and strike a conversation, didn't try to, just lived in those sort of moments. As soon as you try and shape those moments into what you want, I think your brain curses you for trying to bend reality into what you want it to be. And that's to have these sort of moments that just can't exist. And the only times they do exist, as you say, is like in the sort of Gareth Gavanna sort of conventions, where you might be at a table with people and just get on with them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of those, I got Terence Dick's autograph in a Target. So that was okay. I think I gave it to my son to keep on his bookshelf. I can't remember which Target it was, but, you know, it doesn't really matter. But, you know, going back to the Tom Baker thing, I stood in a queue for like an hour in Leeds with a copy of Who on Earth is Tom Baker waiting to get it signed. And, you know, there's people dressed as sidemen and the master nearby. And, you know, I've told this story plenty of times, but there was also a lady with me, which I may not have mentioned previously. And she was my girlfriend at the time. And in my head, she had nothing to do with this meeting. She was just with me. I had no, because, you know, I didn't assume that she'd be in the slightest bit interested in meeting Tom Baker at all. So I just thought we'd get to the end of the queue. I'd go and say hello to Tom Baker and maybe think up something slightly witty. And I may even have had it by the time I got to the end of the queue, that witty sentence or statement or whatever. But it was completely blown away, because after I stepped forward and I handed him my book and I told him my name, about to say something, and he says, does the young lady have anything to do with this? And then she came forward. And then she became a part of this whole scenario that had played out in my head in a completely different way. And then he signed a book to both of us, which, you know, that's, I mean, it's a moment in time, I suppose, from a Time Lord, I suppose, if you like. It crystallized in book form that I'm never going to forget. And there's a person in there who probably shouldn't be there in the long, you know, in the whole scheme of life things, I guess. I don't know, really. It's not something I share with the family. But, you know, so the things, I mean, you can never tell how anything's going to turn out, really, can you?
No. But I think sometimes when you have actors or people in those sort of positions who are doing it a lot and will perhaps not try, I don't mean this in a rude way, but will try and entertain themselves by making encounters a little different by perhaps destabilizing a dynamic. You know, looks up, sees two people, one tall, very eager beaver man desperately wanting to sign his book, probably can see on your face that you've got this idea of how you want this scenario to go. And this lady next to you and thinking, you know, this let's play this up a bit. Let's spin this around.
Hang on. We're talking about Tom Baker here. He definitely wants to talk to the lady. And she was not unattractive. So come on.
I'm not trying to but I mean, I've seen actors or people in those sort of positions who will do that. They will look for ways to try and liven, and in the same way, like you say, engage in whatever their interest is, and just to make it something for them, and therefore that makes it something for you.
Yeah,
they're just difficult environments. And that's my
experience.
I thought
you were going to say they're a different breed then. Either.
But they are. They're very interesting worlds. I mean, fandoms are fascinating on so many levels. And the stuff that goes on and the stuff that goes on behind the scenes, which we've talked about, I think, in private before, from various different fandoms, is some of it's interesting, some of it's shocking, some abuses of power relationships, some egos, some really nice people. And then there's the way that the management works with all that and the staffing works in that and their relationship often as fans, because obviously a lot of staffing in these places are done for either low money or for free. So fans can actually get involved and what power relationships that creates with other fans and with the actors and how that, just so many things going on there. It's a really interesting world. I don't think there's ever any easy answers to how it should be or how to interpret it. I know personally, I stopped liking those cues. And I think I went with my girlfriend at the time to see Lance Henriksen. And I think it was interesting to see how she found that, because it wasn't someone that was interesting to her. But they're just such wacky social spaces, aren't they? Mm. You just, everything's absolutely ratioed. You know, they've got 1,000 things on, they're meeting 1,000 people, they're doing 1,000 things, they know 1,000 people know them in that space, and there's you who know who they are. That's a really weird ratio to be sort of playing with.
In some cases, there's other things going on at the same time as well. So you've got to kind of make a decision. Do you want to go and meet that person, or do you want to go and listen to that talk, or do you want to go and watch that preview or whatever? Yeah. Or do you want to see that artist drawing something live?
And all of those things carry their own pains. I mean, I used to hate going to the Q&As because then you'd always get, as we've talked about this before, you get the people in there who would go in with different agendas again, the ones who want to be noticed, the ones who want to prove their knowledge in front of everyone else, those who ask interesting questions, those who ask questions that can't be answered, those who ask rhetorical questions, you know, and actors spieling out the same stories you've heard before or looking bored or going onto a topic that really interests them to be shut down by the next fan who wants to know about season 2 of Battlestar Galactica. It's all a mess. It's just such a wonderful, crazy mess. And everyone gets different joys out of it. I mean, I know we've been sort of talking about the costs and the problems of meeting these people, but you go onto Twitter and you'll see loads of people with very proud photos that they've taken with these people in their own costumes or, and they're loving it and they enjoy it. And that's the crazy spaces. But like you say, it's a question of either money, localities, and how they're actually presented as small or large spaces.
I think that's an opportune time to get the episode back on track and bring things to a close. Legend of the Sea Devils premieres on Easter Sunday. That's the 17th of April, 2022.
Did we actually...
Sorry, what?
Before we end it, we didn't actually talk about what we thought of it, did we? You did this big thing about well, you know, we're going to talk about the trailer because we won't be able to talk about the actual show. And then we didn't actually talk about the trailer at all.
No, we didn't.
Listing the names.
Okay, so it's on at 7:10 on BBC One on Easter Sunday. It's 50 minutes long, and there's lots of people in it. What did I think of the trailer? I think it looked... the thing is, with Doctor Who trailers...
Yes.
And I guess movie trailers to some extent, but mainly Doctor Who trailers this happens with, there's that whole risk of, have they put all the best bits in the trailer?
Yes.
And that has happened quite a few times with Doctor Who, and I always get worried with trailers. So I just tend to sort of just not look at them too much and just maybe appreciate the atmosphere that they're creating rather than anything too in-depth, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I thought the colours, you know, it felt very different to the stuff we've had recently, especially Christmas. It seemed very fresh, didn't it? The colours were very vibrant. It looked kind of fun. My only issue is that, was it Curse of the Black Spot?
Yes.
Whenever I see a ship in Doctor Who, and this is the first time I've seen a ship in Doctor Who since then, I just think of that episode. It's not a bad episode, but I kind of think, like, you know, how much can you do in that sort of context and world? But yeah, I think it's nice, again, to see a sort of diversity in style, atmosphere, character, you say, writing team sounds interesting. We'll see where it goes. But I thought it was quite a good trailer. But yeah, like you. Wonder if it can meet the epic Inception booming trailer enthusiasm in the flesh when it's aired. Can it carry that action foreboding vibe?
We will find out in a few days' time. We will not be back immediately to discuss this. We will discuss the episode Legend of the Sea Devils once we reconvene. Before we go, quick reminder, if you leave a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, that would be great. If you leave a 4-star or higher, I'll read it out. No one's left one, so there's only 15 ratings still. The last one was in January 2022. You know, I know you feel like you own us to some extent, dear listener, and that we're your personal podcast, but it'd be nice if a few extra people could tune in occasionally, and they can only do that with a nice rating on Apple Podcasts. I do feel dirty for asking, but if you wouldn't mind at some point leaving a review, and if you don't want to, that's fine. Just retweet something or share it on Facebook. You might not have Apple Podcasts.
I tend to find if you're worried as well about the speed that you are going down towards the very bottom of this barrel, your elbows are quite good at slowing down that movement. If you leave some notes, if you leave a star or whatever he wants you to do, we'll give you some tips in how to limit the descent.
At the very least,
because no one knows what's at the bottom there.
Apple Podcasts organises the reviews. There are 15 ratings, but there are only 8 reviews, and they've organised them in rows of 3. So there's 2 complete rows of 3 and 1 row of 2, and it's doing my head in. So if someone could just put a review in there so it's 3x3, that'd be great.
That's fair enough. Do you ever leave reviews? I never leave reviews. Do you leave reviews for stuff?
I've reviewed a few podcasts over the time. I mean, I subscribe on Patreon to the Sitcom Geeks podcast. I listen. I'm a bit mental at the moment about retro gaming, so I listen to the Retro Hour podcast, which is such a good podcast. I don't know why you're listening to me talking about how good that is. Just go and listen to it. If you want slick production, they've got it.
They're in this barrel now. They can bloody well stay here. They're in here with us.
They're rolling.
They can take the journey to the bottom.
Yeah. Is it a barrel of rum?
We'll get there together.
I wonder. Just to get it thematically back on track. We'll be back next time for another Doctor Who podcast. Until then, it's goodbye.